This episode is dedicated to those who lost their lives in a tohoku earthquake disaster, and to those who live on and continue to bear the memories, legacy, and spirit to survive and rebuild. I also acknowledge my debt and gratitude to friends, neighbors, co-workers, supervisors, students, strangers, for their boundless humanity and generosity during that time and after. Hello, welcome to a special edition of the UpToJet podcast, the final part of this two-part series relating to the 2011 Tohoku earthquake. I'm joined again by my guests John Ayong, Kathy Hawker, and Caitlin Lee. In part one, we spoke about our experiences during and just after the earthquake. In part two, we move ahead a few months in time and talk about how the disaster has impacted and continues to impact the communities in our part of Japan. A bit of background if you're new to this podcast. When the earthquake hit, my guests and I were living in the town of Iwaki, Japan, thanks to the JET program. This exchange initiative brings people from overseas to live and be part of local Japanese communities. Most JETs worked as assistant language teachers, others in local government. All JETs are supervised by their local Board of Education, who oversee their living arrangements and work placements. The JET working contract covers a year, which can be renewed up to a maximum of 5 years. Breaking the contract by a JET results in financial penalties. In 2011, due to the earthquake, this was waived, of course, allowing people to break contract and return home. But we had the option of coming back when things got back to a level of normality. So sometime around late April or early May, we got that email. Do you want to come back? Most of us said yes. Part 1. Going back. Most of us made our way back in response to the email. I flew in from Sydney, and some, like John and Caitlin, had stayed on in Japan.
So I stayed 2 weeks at my friend's place in Tokyo because I didn't have running water. Slightly jarring to see how life was back to normal in a relatively close place. It wasn't like the other side of the world. I eventually got back once I knew the bus was kind of like reliable that I could go back. When I got back, I found out that I messed up before I left.
How so?
I got back home and it was like at night, whatever, and the streets were dead quiet, and I was on my iPod. And I got home, I got up my stairs to my living room with my kitchen, and I took off my earphones, and I was like, what's that noise? It sounds like running water. Shit, it's running water. I left the tap on all that time because I was just checking to see if the water was running.
Yeah.
But then in my attempts to check the water, I didn't like turn the tap off.
Oh,
so
no.
It was just left on with no water running until whenever during my 2 weeks that the water got reconnected and I was running. And later on, I got the bill for it.
Oh, no.
It was like a five digit amount.
Oh, my God. That's a
yeah.
lot.
Yeah. You came back just after the water reconnected or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I remember picking you up and then, like, yeah, you had water.
I came, yes, okay. That's right. You came to meet me at the Iwaki
at the station.
Coach. That's right. I'd stepped up the coach, and then yeah. you jumped out from behind a pillar, and it's like, way! Yeah. And then everyone was like yeah. looking at these crazy foreigners doing a dance, yeah. jumping up and down.
Yeah.
That was a really, really nice welcome, by the way. Thank you for that.
Really no, good. That's okay. I mean, really? Like, again, like, you don't expect to think about like, oh, will I ever see this person again?
It was a weird feeling going back. It was an odd feeling getting back to my apartment. I walked through the door at like almost, I think it was almost a month to the like hour after the quake. And yeah, just opened up my door. Everything was as it was left, which was a gigantic mess. And I was very pleased that the things in my fridge hadn't rotted ridiculously. I had refused to clean up my video game and DVD shelf because the day after I got back to Iwaki, so this was what, I think like 4 weeks after the quake or something like that, I had finally got the call that our water was turned back on. So I was like, all right, I'll come back. Came back up from Tokyo and, you know, got inside, decided to clean up a little bit of the stuff we just left that everything was crashed. And then we immediately got the last aftershock that Iwaki got. And everything immediately fell down again. And my water immediately turned off again. So I was somewhat paranoid about putting those DVDs back up. I think about a week later, you eventually cleansed it up for me. And I was fine with that because I was like, you're not Jinx. Go right ahead. I'm Jinxed. I'm not touching this. You can clean it.
I think I was like, I have to do this. I have to fucking clean. I was like, no. No, Caitlin. No, we must clean.
I sorted everything else out except that corner and it was annoying you.
It was like, we may be living through an apocalypse and we don't know if we'll be able to get through this, but hell, we're not going to live like animals.
No. But yeah, it was an odd feeling coming back in. I had like none of the lights were turned on. Everything was kind of dark. You weren't back yet. When that second earthquake hit, I think that I did for a little bit doubt my decision in returning. But I think it was a little bit more just kind of like, I guess that's the universe for you.
Yeah, welcome I'll back. Here's what you missed.
Carry on. Yeah, I was like, I'll just carry on. But I do remember in the months after, our attitude towards the danger of earthquakes got less and less as we experienced more and more. And I do remember that I think you felt the same way in that if our apartment survived the largest earthquake in recent recorded history, it was going to survive all the other ones. So, yeah,
pretty much.
There's no reason to get out of bed.
Although we all made our decision about returning, it wasn't an easy one to make. We had anxieties and self-doubt about whether it was the right one.
You know, we had families and friends, all of us, who thought we were crazy to go back.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, I didn't want to leave. I left for a week thinking it would just be a week. It ended up being three because my family didn't want me to go back. And that was one of the compromises I made. Yeah. I will spend longer in Canada, but know that I will go back. You just deal with the fact that I need to go back. I need to finish this.
Yeah.
And not let the earthquake. That was the other thing. I didn't want the earthquake to define my time on JET in Japan. I needed to finish on a high note there. But going back, worrying that my coworkers and my principal at my base school would react badly, but then seeing my principal smiling at me and saying, thank you so much for coming back. We really, really appreciate it. And giving me the warmest handshake I've ever had in my life. I was just like, oh, thank God. Like, I made the right decision.
Yeah.
I left, but I came back and I'm here and I'm going to work my butt off.
You remember the name of our... Oh, so I remember Kodama-sensei, one of our supervisors. Mm-hmm. What was the name of the other one? Takahama. Takahama-sensei.
Yeah.
Remember our first...
Board of Education meeting?
After we all came back and he saw us and he had this usual smile on his face and he would say like... something like, it does my heart good to see you all back. It's really great. And then he just broke down crying in front of us. And I think that was when I felt, oh yeah, this was the right decision to come back.
Yeah, I remember as well, the difference in attitude, the school staff and other people we kind of regularly interacted with after the earthquake was... It's kind of like, because JETs come and go frequently, you know, like that often people only stay a year. So I think that a lot of the teachers, they don't, you know, they like you being there. They're happy to talk to you, but you're not like a major person they really want to get to know or anything like that because they're busy teachers. They got lots of other things going on.
Yeah.
And they don't know how serious you are about anything either. And then when we return to schools, And their jet hadn't left. You know, there was that whole thing about Flygin, that thing about people who were leaving really quickly and blah, Flygin, blah, blah.
Baijin.
Yeah. Baijin, Flygin. And so I think the fact that we either came back or stayed, it also, you know, like, it was a much more genuine connection with the, you know, the staff ladies and the teachers and things like that afterwards, because we had that shared experience and we had an option to leave and we chose not to.
Yeah.
We chose to stay with the community, even though it was going through all of that.
Yeah.
You know, we chose to return to a place that was having constant aftershocks. I think it was something like a year after that people stopped, like, that people actually started posting about earthquakes on Facebook again, because it had become unusual again. It took like nearly a year for it not to be the norm to have at least a level 4 earthquake once a day or every few days.
Yeah.
It's not like before the earthquake, I felt like anybody, like, people didn't like me or they didn't care. It, you know, they were happy to talk. It still was, you know, interest, but yeah, just that connection you get from being like, I'm here.
Our jobs as teachers allowed us to get a personal insight into the profound effect the disaster had on local communities, especially those by the coast. On my first day back at work, I found myself getting into a minibus with the other staff members en route to the town of Hisanohama, I think it's called, to help clean up the junior high school there. It was a joint effort by several other schools, some of which I worked at, so once in a while I was greeted with shocked but warm recognition by a teacher I knew. Pictures that you see in the media of places like these, they can't compare to seeing things in real life. A landscape flattened and filled with debris where houses once stood, tree trunks shoved right through ground floor windows, watermarks left behind by the sea which were almost a meter above your head, student gym shoes piled up high in the foyer. It was disturbing, sad, and melancholic. Caitlin recounts her experience at one school and her realization that things could have been very different for her that day.
I'm there for the first day. It's very surreal. I've spoken to these teachers and I've seen these kids in the last 8 months, but it's very weird for everyone to be back on that premises. And then not long after, I was sitting in the staff room, maybe like an hour in the morning, figuring out what I'm doing. And the principal walks over and he's like, oh, Caitlin Sensei, do you have any gloves? And I'm like, no, why do I need gloves? What are we doing that I need gloves for? And he hands me a pair of gloves and he's like, come outside. So I go outside and it turns out that it's a escape route evacuation day to practice it.
Right.
Because all of everything before the school was now destroyed, if they had another tsunami come through, it's definitely hitting that school. There's nothing else to stop it. So they actually cut a path into the mountain behind the school. And all the kids were having to practice going up this path. You had to have gloves because the first section of the path was so steep to get immediately out of any danger of water that you literally were holding onto a guide rope to make sure that you could get up. So as I'm coming up this path, there are little kind of like, you know, little kids, 5-6-year-olds, little year one kids who are having to climb this quite high. It's quite steep and I'm not a fan of heights and it was making me feel weird. And, you know, they're like almost in tears trying because they're scared of going up this path. And the teachers are like trying to be like, you know, we've got to practice this now. It's important. And it always struck me that, yeah, for those kids, that experience, like for me as an outsider, I'm like, okay, cool. Like, I know how to do this now if I'm here on this day when it happens to happen. But for the kids going into their school, that's a reminder every single day of what happened here, as long with what's around them.
Yeah.
It's like a stark white path through the mountain up to the top.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was just really odd. And then on that day, I didn't end up actually having any classes because it was a weird day for everyone. And so I took my camera out and took some photos of the area around. Because I guess at some point a group had come through and they had painted a lot of the ruined houses or the walls that were left and had painted the entire seawall as well. Which, yeah, I thought was a nice way to kind of acknowledge what happened, but also talk about moving forward. Lots of the messages on those things were about being strong and that kind of thing. And I don't know if they're ever intending to rebuild that part of Iwaki or not. But yeah, it was a very surreal experience. And I think that day brought a lot of the impact of what had happened and also how incredibly lucky you and I were to be where we were on that day and not be, and, you know, to be able to have each other and to be able to have everyone else and have that support was so lucky. Because if it had been 2 days prior, I would have been on the roof of that school and probably stuck there. Because you weren't getting out of that spot. No one was driving out of there.
I mean, where else was I going to, who's going to cook my dinner?
Exactly, right? How are you going to get food?
How am I going to get food? Yeah.
Part two, taking action and giving back. We all saw what the local people had to endure. Thousands were living in temporary housing or shelters set up in school gymnasiums. Those who came from places severely affected by the nuclear power plant would never be able to return again. Schools whose buildings were destroyed or undergoing repairs had to coexist with another school in the same building, creating crowded classrooms and facilities. Everyday conversations were now concerned with microsieverts and potential contamination from invisible floating radioactive particles. In the coming months, some who moved to other parts of Japan faced discrimination and bullying. And yet, given all the stress they were under, they still, as Caitlin said, gave us a warm welcome. I found it incredible that they actually seemed so grateful that we were back. I mean, weren't we just another thing they had to take care of? And it did something. It inspired the JET community into action. Dozens of grassroots fundraisers sprang up quickly, as well as a haphazard army of volunteers that threw themselves into local cleanup and reconstruction efforts.
All of us in different parts of the prefecture knew that we couldn't just continue being JETs. We had to really involve ourselves in the community. But I think that's part of what JET likes to believe it is. We integrate into the community. We participate in activities and things, and going there and knocking on people's doors on the coast and saying, hey, do you need us to do anything? Do you need any help? And that day that I wrote about digging 100 bags of sand out of this family's garden was the most, like, I volunteered in other places, but that particular day stuck in my mind the most. The physical labor of, and the repetitive motion of filling these 100 bags of sand and feeling like, okay, I've made a tiny dent, but there's still so much more work to do, but the day is done. I have to, like, go and then go to someone else's place tomorrow, kind of thing.
I remember we had tried to go because the local primary school was now an evacuation center.
Oh, that's right. I think, I don't know if I actually, like, kind of pressured you into it. I hope not. Well, my memory says that I suggested that we go to the local shelter and just entertain the kids with, you know, the board games, because you have plenty of board games, and let's play with them. But it was a little bit awkward because my Japanese was kind of crappy and we didn't actually ring ahead.
Yeah, so we just went and spoke to my vice principal, and she was kind of like,
why?
I think she was sort of like I think for her it wasn't that she thought it was a bad idea or anything, but that if we were on the school premises, she would have to be the one to sort of deal with us if there was any confusion.
Right.
So I think it was more that she had 1,000 other things that were more important to consider. I do vaguely remember something like she just eventually was just like, oh, okay, and sort of did that Japanese way of sort of shooing you off.
Yeah, do what you want. I'm busy.
Yeah, that gym was a, like, I think for 3 or 4 months still had people in it.
I think I was a little shocked when I saw So how many, just like all the people in one spot, you know, there were boxes of clothes. It's just that feeling as well that a lot of people had nothing to do.
Yeah.
They're just waiting around.
Sit there, can't do anything.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
because if I remember correctly, I think it was because Iwaki's got space in a sense. And we were the closest kind of main sort of
urban
metro area. So all the people from the towns along the coast and all the towns that were up for radiation concern and things like that, they were all getting bussed into Iwaki as well. So most of the people in those gyms weren't like locals. They were other people who'd be bussed in there, and that's such a stressful situation.
Yeah. The kids, though, were always perky and precocious, and even you couldn't understand them because, I mean, who can understand Japanese from the children?
Too fast.
No, it was like a... Nah, and then a... Nah, and I was like, yeah.
Smile and nod and look excited, and they're down with it. Yeah.
So, but then we never did that again because it was like, okay, we probably should ring ahead next time, but everyone's still really busy. Dear Lord.
There was a lot of help and donations pouring in from all over Japan and the world at this time, almost overwhelming the place with kindness. Imagine if you were a community center having to deal with hundreds of eager minions on your doorstep wanting to volunteer but without a clue about where to go and what to do. But it was quite an amazing, unique experience to be part of a group of people, dare I say a movement, with a common purpose to do good. And as I've said, we, the JET community, threw our collective hearts and souls into volunteering and charity work. So it's not surprising that many of us felt fierce pride and protectiveness about our second home. But there is a downside to this. Online, where all rational, calm debates take place, arguments raged through the JET community about the actions of those who stayed behind in Japan throughout that time and those who left, regardless of whether they returned or not.
I was wanting to talk about the online sort of reaction.
You mean just within like our JET community?
Yeah.
It's part of what we all went through. Some people felt like, no, there's no way that they're leaving. But then there are other people, like for me personally, I couldn't have stayed and continue to have a good relationship with my family. They were so stressed out. They were getting bombarded with people asking them, why is Kathy still there? She needs to leave. Like they were consulting with scientists and experts in the field of nuclear power and things like that. They were to extreme levels worried about me. But then to have that from people that were already in Japan as well, like, oh, you left. Where I'm better than you because I stayed and you left.
It's a weird competition, one-man option that happened that I do not understand.
No, neither did I. I was like, sure, okay, I left. You're right. But I came back. I had to leave to make my family feel safe and feel happy and to give them some sense of peace for the 3 weeks I was gone. But like, what was happening in schools over that 3 weeks? What did we really miss? Our supervisors made every accommodation for us to be able to come back the way we did. And they still felt like, oh, I'm better than you because I stayed.
I just don't
It understand. Doesn't work for everybody. Like,
people have the reasons for going and
yeah, everybody deals with disaster and things like that differently. I don't judge them for staying. That was their choice, their decision. In return, I didn't expect to be judged for my decision. I think if I had the opportunity, I would still leave. If I could go back in time and redo, I would change a bit in the week leading up to leaving. Like I would rethink my carry-on that I packed. Like, I grabbed my passport. So in the back of my subconscious, I knew that I was leaving the country. I should have thought about it more and packed a decent jacket and some decent shoes. But everything else, I wouldn't have changed. I would have still left and still done exactly what I did. And you never know how you're going to deal with a situation like that until you're thrown into it by Mother Nature or some other crazy circumstance.
And much like the early days of the COVID pandemic, we were bombarded with information, rumors and hysteria about what we should have done or not done in the face of possible nuclear contamination.
What access to information we had was like, we didn't know anything better. And then like random things, acid rain,
or microsieverts, and all those kind of terminology. Yeah.
People tried to get information. It was good that we didn't have like too many sources of information like we do now, so that there would be so much stuff we had to go through. But then at the same time, you had to do a lot of work to find it. So it was a good and bad thing. Shout out to Brent. He was ex-Fukushima jet, and he was back in Canada when this all happened. And he was just really taken over by everything. And he started a Facebook group for Fukushima jets to post information about where there was food, where there was petrol, what buses were running and that kind of stuff, who has like space at home, that kind of stuff like that. And I remember he was saying that like at that time his girlfriend, then his wife now, had to like make him get off the computer and just like get some rest or like get some water and then we'll get some food, because it was just like so into making sure that everybody had information. And you know, he was working on a different time zone. He was in Canada, so it was like in on the other side of the world, making sure that this was up and running and that everyone had like information and stuff like that. But yeah, shout out to Brent, man. He helped a lot of us.
Part 3, Legacy of March 11.
Fukushima suffered different damages because of the power plant. The damage and the legacy of that is longer lasting. I mean, you Google Fukushima and that would probably be on the first page. Things like that makes me more protective and more proud of the place that I live there. And then I want to tell people about the place. And actually, I really want people to see that it's not a nuclear wasteland. People still live their lives, function healthily. Hey, I know friends that have had kids, you know, and they've grown up and healthy and businesses are going by their day with no dramas because the place is safe. And I want people to see that, not just like, you know, it's like a nuclear hellhole.
You've stayed there, so you would have seen how Iwaki have progressed, I suppose.
A lot of it was initially the physical healing of it. You saw it more because you traveled further away from Iwaki initially. But there was like the stigma of the evacuees leaving Fukushima. So like there were people who were like stigmatized because they thought that they would carry the radiation or they were dirty for whatever reason, the fear of the unknown. The initial healing of the image as well, Fukushima, because Fukushima is like relatively rural. So it's mainly based on its agricultural economy. So a lot of its produce was tainted by ignorance, not tainted by the radiation. Like there was a big move to say that the food's safe. I mean, the food was probably the safest that you could get in all of Japan because it was like checked, double checked, triple checked by government agencies and then by independent agencies. After the earthquakes and all that, they installed counters at all schools and all public parts to check the radiation. Yeah, it took a while, but like, you know, all the roads got back. It took a long time before they could reconnect the train line from Iwaki up to Sendai, the local train line. Even during a pandemic, JR, the biggest train company in Japan, they're building a hotel at Iwaki Station. throughout all those, like the 10 years that passed, you know, there's been a lot of support and people just like drawing attention to what has happened. I know Ken, the actor Ken Watanabe, he was like one of the first actors to go visit the evacuation shelters to provide whatever support he can. And he goes back to those places every year. For those people that who were not there, the majority of people that were not there, it's just like another event in history. When it becomes like a nice rounded or big number, like fifth year, the 10th year, the 15th, 20th, like a nice rounded, you'll remember it. But otherwise, like it wouldn't be like, you know, something that you're keeping in your thoughts every day.
So much time has passed, right? It's been 10 years. It still feels very much like it's only happened a short time ago for me. Doesn't take very much for the emotions connected to it to come to the surface. You know, like I do tend to get emotional whenever I come across any personal stories or videos or articles about personal experiences during the earthquake.
When I was recounting that, just brought on like a physical response. My legs was shaking uncontrollably. It's still, I look back on it now with the sense of like, it's helped me become the person I am. Because when you're on the jet interview, they're like, we really need you guys to be adaptable and flexible and go with the flow and be able to like change yourself depending on your environment. That the whole experience around the earthquake helped me do that more than my whole entire time on jet. Like everything that jet threw at me, I handled and I grew from that professionally. But being able to actually walk into a situation, assess it and be like, okay, I can roll with this kind of thing. The earthquake gave me that and the experiences after.
Do you think like in comparison to the current pandemic, for example, how we're all feeling isolated and do you think helped prepare you?
I hope so. The experiences that I had, I do feel like that, like the earthquake and everything after and having to deal with like the news and the stress and everything has definitely helped us prepare for the pandemic and everything that goes on.
If I tell some of the stories, especially from my students, it's only been recently that I'm able to sort of get through most of what they tell me without wanting to just dissolve into a puddle of tears. It is just so overwhelming. I can't imagine people that young going through all of that, you know, at their age. And you got adults who are barely able to keep it together during that time. So for me, it's something that's going to stay with me in the back of my head for a long period of time.
A lot of us like take it and respond differently. Like I'm sure some of us might have had some PTSD, you know, there's still like some trauma or fears and a lot of baggage definitely from that type that time. But you know, it is what it is. The main thing is just like how like we carry on and how we respond to it. If the people who are there, the people who live there, the people whose lives are and their roots and family history are like so ingrained in that area in Fukushima, can stand up and carry on and try to make themselves, their lives better, then, you know, like, what have we got to worry about? Like, we can also do the same.
I also forevermore love CC Lemon because it was the last drink in that vending machine near our houses.
Oh my God.
Literally the last bottle. Do you remember? It was the only one lit up and I got it and it was the last bottle in the machine.
Oh my God, yeah.
So forevermore, I will love CC Lemon for that.
CC Lemon for the win, for sure.
Deliciousness to make you feel less weird about the situation you're in.
My deepest gratitude to my guests for revisiting old memories with me and helping to make this episode. You are all simply the best. Missing you all. This podcast was generously supported by CLARE, the Council of Local Authorities for International Relations. However, this is an otherwise independent project by me, Eden Law. All opinions expressed in this podcast are the private opinions of individuals and not representative of any associated organization. Please see the episode notes for music used in this episode. find more episodes under After Jet on SoundCloud, iTunes, or wherever you get your good podcast content from.